From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I am from Livermore.
I'm from East Oakland.
Oakland, near Lake Merritt.
Alameda, California.
Coming up, we'll hear about a ballot proposal that would route more inmates out of prison and towards rehabilitation.
You know, coming from where I come from, like, I never pictured graduating high school, let alone taking college courses, let alone in jail.
Then we'll hear how some inmates process the impact of their crimes.
Understand I did not have the right to take the life of Matthew. I imposed myself on Matthew's right to life.
And we'll talk with the investigative journalist who revealed the patterns in Donald Trump's behind-the-scenes behavior on The Apprentice.
His rating contestants by the size of their breasts, talking about which women he wanted to sleep with, etc. I kept hearing it over and over again.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is next. California's prisons have been dangerously overcrowded for years, and yet another attempt to reduce the prison population is on the ballot in November. It's called Proposition 57. Some Californians are concerned the prop would put the public at risk.
Come November, thousands of convicted criminals could be back on the streets if one proposition is passed by voters.
57 opens doors for violent felons, allowing them to be released from prison early, back into neighborhoods, even yours.
But others say Prop 57 makes us safer by investing in rehabilitation. It would actually affect the juvenile and adult systems a little differently. Reporter Meredith Hodnott tells us more.
Daniel Mendoza is starting classes at UC Davis this fall. He's a junior, a sociology major, and an avid Green Bay Packers fan. But just a few years ago, Daniel was looking at life in prison for a long list of charges.
It was, you know, aggravated assault, so a deadly weapon, murder, gang enhancements. The one thing was that somebody was guilty of murder. Someone died.
How Daniel got from that point to starting classes at UC Davis is connected to California Proposition 57 on the ballot this November. We'll get there in a moment, but first, let's go back to Daniel's story. When Daniel was 14, he was hanging out with a rough crowd. One night, he and some friends jumped a man in the street. In the chaos, someone pulled out a knife and stabbed the man. After a two-month investigation, Daniel and his friends were arrested. In court, Daniel found out that the DA had decided to direct file his case.
I was told that I was being direct filed. I didn't know what it meant at the time. And I shrugged my shoulders and said, okay, you know, not really understanding.
As it stands today, prosecutors can direct file cases at their discretion. That means they can decide whether defendants as young as 14 should be tried in adult court. And this is one of the key things Prop 57 seeks to change. Studies from the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice found that the use of direct file varies widely from county to county, from DA to DA, and is biased against Black and Latino defendants. Their report found that Black youth were over 11 times more likely to be direct filed than white youth.
The race of the child and the county in which he or she commits his crime will determine whether or not he'll be direct filed, not the severity of the crime. And that is not what we should be basing these decisions on.
The stakes are high for young defendants. While the juvenile system focuses on rehabilitation, with options ranging from serving time under supervision at home to incarceration at a juvenile hall, in the adult system, there is only punishment and prison. Frankie Guzman from the National Center of Youth Law explains the effect he sees on these young defendants.
Not only are we denying the benefit of rehabilitation, we are ensuring all the negatives that the adult system carries. And so we often see young kids who really quickly have to grow and develop in a prison environment that is extremely violent and choose a road that is between being a wolf and being a sheep.
Instead of direct file, Proposition 57 would ensure that young defendants must have a fitness hearing in juvenile court before deciding whether or not they should be transferred to the adult system.
The difference here is a decision-making process made by a judge with a whole lot of information about the kid, the offense, and the background versus a decision made by a prosecutor who has very little to no information.
For Daniel Mendoza, the consequences of being direct filed didn't sink in for a while.
Because honestly, you know, a 14-year-old looking at life in prison, like, what does he have to look forward to? I kind of numb myself and shut down emotionally just so, you know, I can kind of survive, get on to the next day.
But Daniel got lucky. He was held at the county juvenile hall while his case was in trial. And a teacher there took an interest in him and encouraged him to reinvest in his education.
I picked up a book for the first time and I never stopped. I haven't stopped.
It turns out Daniel is a voracious learner. Taking class after class, he went from a seventh grade reading level to getting his high school diploma, and then moved on to college courses online. Along the way, he picked up a community of support from teachers, mentors, counselors, and probation officers. And after more than 4 years of trial, Daniel pleaded out, and his case was kicked back to the juvenile court.
All of a sudden, I'm in a system where there are options for me.
The community Daniel had built rallied around him and helped him get his sentence suspended. He immediately went to community college, got his associate's degree, and transferred to UC Davis. Stories of incarceration and rehabilitation like Daniel's are at the heart of Prop 57, but you wouldn't know that based on the discourse surrounding it. That's because Prop 57 also affects the adult system. It encourages adult inmates to participate in rehabilitative programs and increases the opportunities for parole for nonviolent felons.
Rehabilitation is the common theme. We no longer want to have a criminal justice system that focuses on punishment to the complete exclusion of rehabilitation.
Governor Jerry Brown has championed this proposition as a way of correcting the tough-on-crime legislation of the past few decades, some of which he helped pass. But opponents see a poorly written measure that could have disastrous consequences. Their primary concern is the lack of a definition of a nonviolent crime. They say Prop 57 could lead to the release of felons whose crimes are heinous, but don't happen to fall under the narrow legal definition of violent.
Tell me, if you would, whether you consider the following crimes to be nonviolent: assault with a deadly weapon, soliciting another to commit murder, rape of an unconscious person, sodomy by intoxicating anesthetic or controlled substance.
That was Larry Morse, district attorney for Merced County, at a legislative informational hearing on Prop 57.
I could go on and on and on.
Even if the definition of nonviolent isn't clear, Prop 57 doesn't automatically grant early release. It only offers an earlier chance to make a case to the State Board of Parole Hearings. And opponents say that undercuts the trial system by giving more power to an ambiguous parole process.
And it makes judges essentially advisory personnel in the handling of cases that come before them.
The Legislative Analyst's Office says that Prop 57 would affect 30,000 inmates who currently serve only about 2 years in prison before being eligible for parole. Frankie Guzman points out that all these inmates are going to be released from prison one day anyways.
The question that we have to ask ourselves, and especially in the context of voting for Prop 57, is how do we want them coming home? Do we want them coming out worse than they went in, the same, or better?
As for Daniel, he's really looking forward to voting for Prop 57 this November, especially because many people with his criminal background don't have that right. In Oakland, I'm Meredith Hodnott for Cross Currents.
Find all our election coverage, including crib sheets with quick summaries of all the California and San Francisco ballot measures, at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Prop 57 is about inmate rehabilitation, but what does that sound like up close and in person? San Quentin State Prison is the place to find out.
The San Quentin Prison Report.
Bringing you hidden stories from life inside.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell,
You see what goes on?
As I like to be free, I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop.
San Quentin has a lot of programs to prepare inmates for life after prison. One of them is GRIP, or Guiding Rage into Power. It's a 52-week program that teaches the men how to stop their violent behavior, cultivate mindfulness, understand victim impact, and develop emotional intelligence. From the San Quentin Prison Report, Lewis A. Scott has the story.
My name is Jacques Verdun. I started working in prison about 18 years ago. I represent the community, and we're trying to prevent re-victimization.
Jacques Verdun is the founder of GRIP, a self-help group here at San Quentin State Prison.
GRIP is like a comprehensive offender accountability program, and it's like a best practices methodology.
The acronym stands for Guiding Rage into Power. The program lasts for 52 weeks, and the curriculum is tough.
So we felt there were like four elements that we wanted to address. The first one is learning how to understand and stop my violence.
My name is John Lamb, and this is an apology letter to the family of Matthew Sievert. Understand what I say will never restore what I senselessly took away from you. It is in that light, for one reason or another, my words always seemed inadequate when I began writing you this letter.
Second one is developing emotional intelligence.
It has taken me a long time to accept accountability for Matthew's death. I defer blame away from myself and hid in denial by blame others. I was self-centered. I only thought of myself and what I was going through.
Third one is cultivating mindfulness.
I understand I did not have the right to take the life of Matthew. I imposed myself on Matthew's right to life, and your family and friends' right to have him in your lives. I am deeply remorseful for the grief and suffering I have brought into your life. I sincerely apologize with all my heart for your hurt, pain, and loss of your son, loved one, and dear friend.
And the fourth is understanding victim impact.
As the world celebrates the holidays, you are mourning the loss of your son. I know that not only the holidays, but each day for you is a tragic reminder of the loss you have suffered because of me.
We have about 34,000 lifers in the state. Many of them have done their work and could be released. You take the emotion out of it and you just follow common sense and the data, you see that many of those folks could be released without any public safety concerns.
I sent this to the victim's office services, but it was returned to me, because they said that they no longer accept letters from offenders.
Office of Victim Services normally acts as a mediator between the offender and the victim. Their funding was cut, so they can no longer provide those services. But the GRIP program keeps moving forward, encouraging participants to guide rage into power. For San Quentin Prison Report, I'm Lewis A. Scott.
And a big congratulations to Lewis A. Scott. He received a Greater Bay Area Journalism Award this month from the San Francisco Peninsula Press Club. Check out more from the San Quentin Prison Report at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Now let's turn to the biggest story on the national stage, the final days of the race to be president. Garance Burke is a San Francisco-based reporter with the Associated Press. She investigated Donald Trump and is behind the scenes behavior on the long-running show The Apprentice. The program pitted contestants against one another in an effort to get hired, or not fired, by Trump, who starred on the show between 2004 and 2015. Garance Burke conducted her research for 2 months before publishing an article on October 3rd, a piece that led to a big reveal and some changes in the national dialogue. KALW's Ben Trefney asked her for the details on what she found.
Well, I started off with a pretty open-ended question. What was it like to work with Mr. Trump on The Apprentice? And pretty soon I got the sense that he was saying a lot of things about women's bodies on set that people hadn't necessarily heard of before. He was talking about which female contestants he wanted to sleep with, asking the male contestants on the show to talk about which female contestants they'd like to have sex with, rating contestants by the size of their breasts, and also there was a particular camera woman who Trump had taken a fancy to and apparently would talk a lot about her body, give her a lot of unwanted attention. Now, we tried reaching out to her. She didn't want to talk about it, and her husband said she didn't have a problem with Donald Trump. But numerous other crew who I spoke to said it really was very noticeable and uncomfortable for a lot of folks on the set.
Well, and that sort of thing when essentially the main talent, and I'm not sure, he wasn't exactly the boss of the show, even though the show was really about him and his relationship with people. If the person at that level is making comments about others, subordinates in the show, they're put in a very difficult position, obviously.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, over time, both the cast and the crew began to feel like there were just some really uncomfortable comments. He asked female contestants to twirl before him so he could check out one woman's physique. He would rate the female contestants by the size of their breasts, talk a lot about their breasts. So just, you know, issues that wouldn't come up necessarily in your normal workplace.
Is that sort of Hollywood in a way? Have you thought about ways in which this is, you know, pop culture TV, which also has a lot of like sort of sex drive?
Yeah, I think it was really interesting to talk with crew about their feelings, because some said, you know, no one's really going to care if we come forward and tell you what it was really like to work with Mr. Trump. I think that for a lot of the former crew, this was something that they had come to expect on the set of a reality TV show, which, as you said, you know, is rife with sexual innuendo. But of course, you know, it was also the place that gave Donald Trump a real launch into popular culture as sort of the ultimate boss, if you will. So our interest was figuring out, well, what is it like to be in that work environment where Trump is the ultimate boss?
Mm-hmm. Did you have cooperation from NBC and the show producers when you were conducting your investigation of The Apprentice?
You know, NBC did not want to comment on the show. They said that they merely licensed the footage and that the production work was really the responsibility of the executive producer, Mark Burnett. Mark Burnett, unfortunately, didn't comment before we published our story, but afterward did put out a statement saying that he was not a supporter of Mr. Trump's and that also he would not be in a position to release the footage.
Of course, if the people who produced The Apprentice were to go through their tapes, then they might be able to find all kinds of things that he had said. I mean, certainly if 20 people or so, is that how many people said that they had allegations about Donald Trump? Then there's probably a lot in those tapes that's not being shown right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interest really continues to get a better sense of what is in those outtakes, you know, what happened when the mics and the cameras were rolling and didn't ultimately get into the broadcast version of The Apprentice. I should say also that I spoke to a number of people who worked on the show and appeared on the show who had nothing but good things to say about Donald Trump and felt he was really a compassionate boss, you know, and a great leader and, you know, was a great person to work with.
That includes many women.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, some of the contestants who I spoke to said they never really felt uncomfortable with the statements that he had made. They just sort of took it in stride as playful banter.
Even if they had heard those kinds of things from him, maybe commenting on looks or a little flirting.
Right. Yeah. So it's been an interesting realm of reporting because so much just depends on a person's perspective. What for one person may be an aggressive statement that's offensive, another person may take as playful banter.
One thing that strikes me, too, about this is, I mean, Donald Trump is a powerful man in a business position, and there is a lot of sexism in workplaces, whether it's as overt as, you know, what these people have said about Donald Trump, or if it's more subtle, you know, microaggressions that people can have, or flip statements that can drop, or pay issues. I mean, there's a whole lot of that, which maybe makes this an extraordinarily egregious case, and especially for somebody who's running for president of the United States. But also, maybe there's just a widespread sexism in workplaces.
Well, I think one of the things that was most gratifying to me was to see that after reading my article, producers at Access Hollywood decided to go back and look at their own footage to see what evidence of Trump's behavior towards women they may have had lying around in their archives. And of course, they found the now infamous Trump tapes, you know, in which he details his sexual aggression towards women. So I think that, you know, it's sort of unleashed the floodgates for many folks and colleagues at different media outlets, including AP, to take a broader look at these issues.
Mm-hmm. How many people would you say you interviewed overall?
I interviewed more than 60 people for this story.
So it sounds like at least a third of the people who you interviewed had something to say about Donald Trump making sexualized comments.
Yeah, that's right. And it was surprising to me. I, again, went into it with a pretty open mind, wondering if I would find people who thought he was a terrific boss. And so it was unusual to hear that many people in separate interviews corroborate one another's stories and tell very similar anecdotes about what they had experienced on set regarding Donald Trump's behavior towards female cast and crew, you know, his rating contestants by the size of their breasts, talking about which women he wanted to sleep with, et cetera. I kept hearing it over and over again.
Garance Burke is an investigative reporter with the Associated Press. She spoke with KLW's Ben Trefney. Since her article was published, another 11 women have come forward accusing Donald Trump of sexual misconduct. Find Garance Burke's article at klw.org. Click Cross Currents. And that's all for us today. Our team includes Leela Day, Olivia Henry, Jurgen Klemm, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Chris Hoff, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Kavalroop Singh, Andrew Stelzer, and Bowen Wong. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This is the voice of Lauren Hulbert from Oakland. She'll be in San Francisco tomorrow performing at Hotel Utah around 8 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
As the water slides, spins him south through the suddenly, sun shone down. Illuminated.